Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Today's guest is Andrea Luman. We talk about fantasy, urban fantasy, playwriting. It's a great interview where we kind of go all over the place with storytelling. Before we get into our interview with Andrea, let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. Edge of Valor, a military sci-fi thriller by Josh Hayes. When their mission fails, his begins. David Weber calls it a tour de force. Special Agent Jackson Fisher is a man after truth. When a military operation to extract a high-ranking ambassador from the war-torn border world of Stonemire ends in disaster, Fisher is called in to investigate. A whole platoon went in, but only three Alliance Marines returned home. The rest killed in action along with hundreds of civilians. With tensions between the Holloman Alliance and Stonemire rising, Fisher attempts to stitch the pieces together. One thing becomes more and more certain. The surviving Marines are lying. As the truth unfurls, Fisher begins to realize this was far more than a simple rescue mission, and that the truth might be something best left buried. Filled with action, mystery, and well-crafted characters, Edge of Valor, the Valor series book one, will put you into a world of war, conspiracy, and betrayal. It's perfect for fans of David Weber's Honorverse or Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan with a futuristic flair. That's Edge of Valor by Josh Hayes. Chronicle of the Five by Garrett Godrick. From book one, a peculiar boy with a remarkable ability, a secret society on a dark crusade, an extraordinary device that could change the world. 14-year-old Cody Calder is a frightened, insecure boy who wants nothing more than to find courage and self-worth, and he has a difficult decision to make. He can go with his family and confront his fears or stay behind and hide at his uncle's farm. If he stays, he must say goodbye to the two most important people in his life. If he goes, his decision could change him forever. Cody's choice lands him in a faraway place where he finds himself on an unexpected path filled with mind-bending twists of fate and decision. And Cody's quest for self-discovery becomes a nightmare as he struggles to survive in an extraordinary new world, one he never knew existed. Book 1, Dark Revenant, and Book 2, Dark Legacy, are available now, with Book 3 coming soon. Chronicle of the Five by Garrett Godrick. R.J. Pinero and his brand new book, Chilling Effect, a global climate thriller. A ruthless eco-terrorist, a woman determined to stop him. Chilling Effect, R.J. Pinero's newest thriller, explores a world in the not-too-distant future where terrorism is taken to a new level, one with world-ending consequences. You never know what you're capable of until the monster inside of you pushes you beyond your moral line in the sand. These are the opening thoughts of former climatologist William Christed as he prepares to attack our delicate ecosystem. He's hell-bent on avenging his father's death and will go to extremes of terrorism never before seen, all to strike a blow to those whose hubris led to his father's demise. He will take full advantage of the greed and narcissism ever present in the world, as well as the fragility of our planet to ecological terrorism, and use it to plot a scenario so grim, yet so compellingly real, it could have ripped from today's headlines. Check out the brand new thriller Chilling Effect from R.J. Pinero. Michael Anderle has a brand new series that's launching. It's called Opus X, and the first book is Obsidian Detective. Two rebels whose worlds collide on a planetary level. On the fringes of human space, a murder will light a fuse and send two different people colliding together. She lives on Earth, where peace among the population is a given. He is on the fringe of society, where authority is how much power you wield. She's from the powerful, the elite. He's with the military. Both want the truth, but is revealing the truth good for society? Check out Obsidian Detective, the very first book that's up for pre-order now, from the new series Opus X by Michael Anderle. If you love comics the way I do, go check out Cool Comics in My Collection at edgosney.com. Ed runs one of the best comics blogs on the internet. New episodes each Thursday come out, digging into the things that we have loved about comics and comic collecting. There's something there for everyone. Go check out Cool Comics and My Collection at edgosney.com. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have my friend Andrea Luman on the show with me. She has a fantastic book called Missing Wings. It's the first book in the Chronicles of the Irani Sargas series, and we were just chatting a minute ago, and she let me in on some news that there's a follow-up coming in just a few months that I know you guys are really going to love. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. I'm a big fan of Missing Wings and have been for a while, so I think it'd be a lot of fun to talk fantasy writing today. Yeah. But as you know, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
That's a great question. I was a child, and I used to take cross-country road trips with my parents. Most of my extended family is from Indiana, and so we would take these 11, 12-hour road trips in the car. And as a kid back then, you know, we didn't have things like iPads or iPhones or Game Boys or any of that. And so a lot of my time was spent going into what my stepmother would always refer to as La La Land. And I was forever from that point forward making up stories in my head. And so I began writing them down, and I have a bunch of really kind of pathetic younger stories from my childhood, but it's cute because it's like, oh yeah, I've been doing this for a really long time.
So yeah. You were traveling to Indiana. Where were you traveling from?
Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota.
Okay. So yeah, that's, were you a big fantasy fan at the time? Like what were your kind of go-to stories?
Well, I grew up, my dad would read to me a lot, which was a lot of really cherished memories for myself, was my dad reading to me. So, and then one of the first books that we read together in grade school was like fifth grade, I want to say fifth or sixth grade, he read The Hobbit to me. And so that kicked off us reading Narnia together. And then from there, I kind of figured out, this is totally my thing. I love these kinds of stories. And so I started getting whatever I could get my hands on fantasy wise was what I would do. So, and then when, as I got older, I loved to go to the bookstores and browse by cover. So I find a lot of fantasy friends as well. Like we all have the same memory of like going to the bookstore and browsing by cover, because you'd have all the different paperbacks lined up, and like the artists that would do Anne McCaffrey's book.
Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it was the best. It was the best.
Oh, that's fantastic. Do you remember the first story? And it was it The Hobbit that just completely transported you to another world?
It that definitely took me to another place, but I think Lloyd Alexander's series they made a Disney movie out of it, and it was like the most scary Disney movie ever. The Black Cauldron, that series really kind of did it for me when I was younger. Really, really loved it.
Nice. Do you remember writing your first story?
I do. And then I remember hating it. And I think most authors kind of go through that where, you know, everything you write, you're like, oh, this is terrible. And then you write some more and, oh, this is terrible. And I had a seventh grade English teacher who told me I could never be a writer because I'm a terrible speller. And that kind of crushed me. I was crushed. I had to like now come up with some other ambition for my life because this seventh grade teacher told me I could never be a writer. And then in ninth grade, it just so happened that my English class was a creative writing class. And my ninth grade teacher held me after class one day and he's like, you know, you kind of got a thing for this writing thing. And I'm like, no, I can't. I can't. I'm not a good speller. Not my thing. I couldn't do that. And he goes, well, what do you think editors are for?
You're right.
And light bulb moment, my ninth grade self. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I didn't even think about that. So yeah. So then I did. I went on to college. I studied playwriting during my Bachelor of Arts degree. So
Really?
I. Yep, that was what I got my degree in. And so then it was a big challenge when I decided, hey, I've got this story in my head that just will not stop. And I think I should write it down. And I'm like, oh, this is a novel. And I've never actually written a novel. And so I went back and I started really kind of doing some professional reading on like properly constructing a novel and exposition and fun things like that that I never really had to worry about when I was, constructing a play. So, yeah, it was a big adventure. Plus, I had four small children at the time. They're now in grade school, so I don't have them running amongst me while I'm trying to put the story in my head onto paper. So, I have more downtime to kind of write as I feel fit. So,
Well,
yeah.
I'm fascinated by the playwriting. Our family has all of my kids have done community theater and some school theater and stuff like that. And we've been very supportive of that. And my oldest son and I have done a couple of plays together. And it's a lot of fun, and it's a completely different creative outlet. To get to take someone else's words and put them on the stage. But I'm really fascinated by the way these different artistic expressions intersect, and playwriting and novel writing are so completely different, yet they have a lot of similarities. What do you think that you learned from playwriting that makes you a better novelist?
Well, the interesting part of playwriting versus the novel is in a play you've got action driving the scene on stage and you have to move that action forward, but a lot of times you really can only create so much. You're limited a lot of times by the space itself. So there needs to be interesting dialogue to carry the scene, and there also needs to be interesting characters to carry the dialogue. So I was very invested in developing strong characters and then developing strong dialogue. And I figured I really don't have to worry too much beyond that because I came from a thought in theater where that's really what you need. And the artists that surround you that do everything else, give them the freedom to have the freedom to create what they do best, which is the direction and the acting and the costume design and the set design, whatever that should be. So it's totally an artistic like theater thing that I grew up thinking that was my mindset. Not everyone has the same mindset, but that's where I came from. And so when I started looking at doing this fantasy novel, it was the same kind of thing. I had the same type of interactions with characters and the same type of momentum, but I'm like, oh, I've actually got to express the vision that's in my head on paper. I can't leave this up to other people. And so that's when the more visual piece of it, the exposition, the place, the world building came into play. And then how to time that out and pace it, because there's definitely a pace to writing a fantasy or science fiction novel that's not the same as any other novel, even though you want to use the same type of, you want to keep the reader engaged. I hate those writers that kind of go on the old school principle of thought where it's like, oh no, I've got easily 200 pages before I have to engage my fantasy reader. You kind of feel used as a fantasy reader. Like, really? Did you really have to take 200 pages? So I try to think of them as well as, how would I want this story to be conveyed to me as somebody who's a big lover of fantasy genre? So.
Well, it's really interesting because a lot of those old fantasy and science fiction books, you're absolutely right that the pace is completely different. And I had a conversation with Terry Brooks one time, and he even admitted that you know, if he were going to publish the Sword of Shannara today, it would have to, that beginning would have to be, you know, changed, because it's 100 pages before anything happens in that book. And it's so funny how, you know, our taste change, or just kind of the expectations of readers maybe change over time. It's crazy.
And there's so much that people can be doing when you think about it, you know. So there's so much media, there's so many movies, there's so many shows. You can binge watch seven seasons of a season that, you know, we used to have to wait an entire week to watch one episode of. So the pace and the frequency of people enjoying things has changed quite a bit. So if you really want to keep that person who decided to pick up a book and try to read it, if you really want to get them invested in your work, you should not spend 100 pages doing it. That's my philosophy.
what do you think, you know, when you're kind of wrestling with taking the way you know how to tell a story and the way you've been trained in school to tell a story, and then approaching that as a novelist, where as a playwright, you know, this is a very collaborative thing. You're going to write the dialogue, and you're going to you know, put some sparse stage direction on there, and then the director and the actor is going to interpret that and add their own flair and their vision for that. But when you're the novelist, you are in complete control. What are some things that you discovered pretty quickly that you needed to do to grab the reader's attention and to pull them into the story?
Everything had to mean something. And I got that advice from a friend of mine who writes nonfiction, historical nonfiction, but he was very clear in his advice. He's like, everything needs to mean something. If it's in there, it should be part of the story. It needs to be essential. If it's not essential, take it out. If the scene is not essential, take it out. If the banter is not essential, take it out. Like, there has to be a very clear reason for everything that you're presenting to the reader, because again, they're giving you their time, and you don't want to lose them because they're just simply bored going through whatever you're showing them. So I think that's a big piece of it. And the same would be true to theater. Like, you would never want to lose your audience because they're bored, because the characters are just rambling about who cares on stage. And it would never be allowed in a television show or a movie. Like, people are never going to tolerate that. They're going to walk out. They're going to leave. They're going to be like, why did we put this in the movie? This doesn't make any sense. They're rambling about nothing. But you still, like you said, you'll find these things in older works where you're like, I don't even understand. And I've seen it in some modern works. I will say that. And I'm like, I think the editors are sometimes afraid of some of these big names, and they don't touch their stuff. They're just like, yep, just send it to print. We don't need to edit that. And then you get them and you're like, I don't even understand what just happened there as
right.
a reader. So,
and then you're like, am I allowed to have an opinion about this? It sold like 50 million copies, but I personally don't like it. You know, can I have an opinion? Yeah, it's crazy. So you had this the story idea that was nagging at you, and you've got four small kids and you know, but this thing starts growing in you. Where did the idea for the story come from? What's the first memory you have of these characters that started coming alive to you?
Interesting enough, it was a scene that's still in the book. It was an argument between Katrina and Jance's brother, and Griff. So Chain. So she has this argument with Chain, and I could see the characters and I could see the arguments, and it was just so... there was so much behind it that I'm like, this is really interesting. What's going on here? Like, so I was intrigued by, like, where did all this start? How did this come about? And you start digging around with these characters, and the story just kind of grew from there. So I initially met, you could say as an author, I met Katrina and Chain and Jance first. Those were the first three characters that I knew of. And then I slowly got to learn about the family dynamic, Katrina's family dynamic. Her mother had a very strong presence, which, you know, she has a very strong presence in the book. And then just the the family dynamic intrigued me and how everyone was affected by this one moment that changed her whole family's life. And so that's kind of what you'll see going forward with the series, is that how that moment of what happened to their father affected each one of these siblings. And
So
yeah, sorry.
tell me about Katrina, and tell me about the world that you created, because this is a fantasy story. What is the fantastical nature of this story?
So there's humans, but then there's also several, fantastic creatures that you may or may not have dealt with in other readings. So there's griffins and there's minotaurs, but within Katrina and her world itself, there's a grouping of people that come from a culture where they have seven different types of abilities that they can shift into. So some of them, like, visibly will have a physical shift and change, while others will have a manifestation of sorts. So there's guardians who can actually shift the thoughts of people or physically put them to sleep, essentially. And then there are those who have an actual physical change. And some are more dominant than others. The warrior class is definitely one of the more dominant ones. They're physically bigger. They have a much more aggressive presence, to a point where when they go through puberty, they're put into a special compound that they have to learn how to deal with their own body's changes because it's so different than the rest of their population. That in order to keep the population safe, they have to learn how to control themselves. And then you've got others that may or may not choose to ever decide to shift. So you have those who can shift and manipulate their features to look like other people. And some are really good at it. They can do it all the time. They can hold it for a long period of time. And then others that just decide they never really want to shift at all. And then you have an entire group that lives in the ocean. They're ocean shifters of sorts. They have take on like an aquatic animal shape, and they live on islands and actually control one of the largest areas of the different regions that these people live. So it's an extensive population with a lot of different cultural variables, and then how they also interact with humans. There's some cultural and political variables as well. And Katrina happens to have one of the rarer forms because there was a genocide of sorts against her type of shifter. There's also one type of shifter that's been, as far as they know, completely disseminated. They're dead. And they've been dead for close to 200 years, as far as anyone knows. And they had a special magical property where they lived for longer periods of times, and they could embed different, they could make things magically themselves. And we don't know how, people don't really know, remember why, but they're gone. And then they almost lost the type of shifter that Katrina is in a similar fashion. That way, because they're so rare, they're more protected and they're more aggressively kept. And also because of the connection that they're supposed to have with their God. Every area within their region, each region has its own guide, and the guide is one of these already. So it was almost killed off. It's a long
When you're
long explanation.
when you're building your fantasy world, like you said, there are some existing creatures that that we might be familiar with, and just as fans of fantasy, griffins and minotaurs and things like that. When you're building your fantasy world, how much freedom do you have to take existing ideas that people have and switch them up, make things your own? I guess what I'm asking is how much freedom do readers give you to explore and to kind of switch things up that we all are familiar with? Does that make sense at all?
I think as long as something is plausible, the reader will go with it. It's when you lose your reader on cultural weird fantasy things. It's when something just seems completely implausible that they're like, there's no way. This is just crazy. Or if you can't describe it or the whys behind it accurately to the reader, to where they're just confused. So you don't want to confuse anybody, and you want to make sure that, you know, they can unplug from reality. And if it's plausible enough that in this fictitious place, they're going to go with it.
So set rules and then live within the rules that you set.
Oh, yeah, because readers, I mean, and I know myself as a fantasy reader, if you break your rules, your readers will hate you. It's really obnoxious when an author forgets their own rules that they've established within their own fantasy realm. Super annoying.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. So within the fantasy world, this world interacts with our world. What happens with how do we as humans become involved in this story?
So there's animosity between the people that Katrina is from and the humans themselves. And her own mother is a human. So her mother is one of the few humans that live within her father's household. And she was actually his favorite wife. So he's got all these wives, and his human one happens to actually be his favorite. But there's history there between all the wives and her father that lead to what happens to him. And Katrina's taken by her mother back to or into a human world, and in the process loses her ability to shift and doesn't know if she's going to be able to get it back, and doesn't know if or when she's going to be able to get home. Like, she desperately wants to get home, desperately wants to be restored, but these things actually happening could potentially be a danger to herself and her family. And so it becomes a period of waiting it out and doing what you can, making the best of the situation. And during that process, she learns different things about herself that she then is able to carry forward when she does get to go home. But in the process, she makes mistakes, and the mistakes could be something that could start a war within her own people.
What's fun about fantasy, a lot of times is the ability to look at situations in our real world, and to have fun with those, to play them out in different ways in the midst of this fantasy setting, to introduce magic into kind of our real world problems and things like that. A lot of times we can tell a story about the real world around us, but couch it in this other place and time. Are there themes that you explore with this book and the series, or is this just a fantastical story about life?
There are some themes, but I wouldn't say I've blatantly taken anything current and dumped it into the book. I think one of the strongest themes I explore is friendship versus family bond. Is one stronger than the other? Is one just talk, or is it real? That's kind of looked at and examined from different angles. As well as, you know, how do you define yourself? And I think something that anybody can relate to, it's the you finally get what you want, and then you move into it, and were you actually ready for what you got kind of moment. So a lot of people can relate.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And
You thought you wanted it, but were you really?
oh yeah. Well, and that theme of a family that you're born with and family that you create, you know, those friendships and things like that is such a strong that's something everyone can relate to, and it's something that's fun to play out on the page.
It was fun. It was very And it's still fun because it's still continuing for me.
Right, right.
I get to look at it more from a different angle in the next book. So,
So what can you tell us about the next book? Where will it pick up, and what can we expect from it?
there's a couple things that were left as like open doors, so to speak, and it mainly related to her older brother. So the oldest of Katrina's siblings is Valgu. And what happens to him? So the next book is from his point of view. You still get to see Katrina and what's going on in her life, but again, it's strictly from his point of view as the protagonist in the second book. And it picks up slightly before the end or the climax of Katrina's book, but you'll see it from Valgu's point of view. So even if you've read the first book and you know kind of what happens to Valgu, you don't really know where he's going or his mindset for the choices that he makes at the end of the book, and that's where it goes. So you see what happens to it from him from his point of view, and then you see his decision, and you learn things that really weren't they were hinted at, but they weren't totally revealed to the reader in the first book. So
And that
I'm
book's gonna
excited
be,
to reveal that.
and that's gonna be coming out sometime spring.
I'm hoping February or March. Yep.
Awesome, awesome. We're looking forward to it. When someone picks up a copy of Missing Wings and the subsequent book when it comes out, what do you hope people are left with at the end of the book?
I hope they feel connected to the characters, like the main characters, you know. I would hate for someone to go through the whole book and go, "Wow, I really hated that character." Because I don't design it for you to intentionally hate the main characters. So if that's what you're coming away with, I'm really sorry.
Love it. I love it. Well, it is Missing Wings is a highly entertaining read. If you're a fan of fantasy of any stripe, you're gonna love this book. We're gonna put a link to it in the show notes. Andrea, if people are just learning about you, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yeah, I'm really easy to find. You can find me on Amazon. I'm Andrea Luman, or last name is Luhman, or my website is www.andrealuman.com.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to see you and to pick up their copy of Missing Wings. Andrea, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thanks again.
Thanks to Andrea Luman for joining me today on Author Stories. Be sure to check out her work in the show notes of the show at hankgarner.com. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleave's The Jason Crane Series.
You took a terrible risk tonight.
Why?
You don't know? The first rule.
I was told by a friend that I shouldn't reveal my gift to anyone who doesn't have a gift themselves.
That's exactly right.
Because everyone we tell dies.
Yes. You might have marked me for death.
Made you a target for a ghost. Why can't people know what we can do? What makes it so dangerous? Valerie took up the fireplace prongs and stabbed the logs.
It's called the Great Curse.
Sparks exploded from glowing crevices and drizzled upwards, ricocheting off the black belly of the cauldron, turning into tiny ashes that disappeared up the chimney.
It was cast by a powerful witch over 300 years ago.
Witch? Sorry, but witch? Please, there's no such thing. Valerie closed her eyes. A spoon leapt from Jason's dish and caught him in the temple. He wiped melted ice cream from his cheek. You were saying?
She cast the curse to stop the witch trials.
In Salem? Jason searched his memory. 1690.
1692. They burned her alive. In the Salem Common, the only witch to be burned.
The cauldron smoked slightly. Its contents had evaporated. A sharp, charred scent filled the room. Wait, said Jason. There were no witches. They were just I don't know, victims of religious hysteria, right? So you're saying the witch trials were justified?
Justified? So if a witch did exist, it would be okay to kill her?
No, I just thought... You're right. Never mind.
There was one witch in Salem, at least. A woman with a powerful gift. She only wanted to protect people like us. To give the gifted their anonymity, refuge. She cast the Great Curse as she burned. She proclaimed that mortals who know a witch shall know death. And that is the Great Curse. And it's still in effect after all this time.
Mortal, as in?
Non-gifted. No mortal can know about you, about any authentic witch.
Jason winced. Isn't there another word besides that? She shrugged. So no one can know what I am, what I can do, or else they become a target.
Right. The spirit world will obey the Great Curse and try to kill them.
The spirit world.
The other realm.
Jason rubbed his eyes. How much of this was reality and how much of this was Valerie's nutty brand of mysticism? He felt himself pulling back, as usual, for fear of contagion. He'd spent his whole life reading science fiction. He hated paranormal tales. This was not his genre.